Hey, this is Adam Carolla telling you to listen to the Antique Auction Podcast with Martin Willis.
Hi, everyone. This is Martin Willis, and welcome to the Antique Auction Podcast Show. We now have two different kinds of segments, the usual informative segment, such as the one you're about to hear, and segments involving upcoming auctions of interest, interviewing auctioneers and staff. You can always email us at auctionpodcast@me.com. We're always looking for suggestions and new ideas, and we look forward to reading the emails. Thank you, and enjoy the show today. Hi, everyone. Today we have a phone guest, Gary Guyette, president of Guyette and Schmidt, the premier decoy auction company in the world. Hi, Gary.
How are you doing?
Doing pretty well. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your company and how it all started?
Sure. Let's see. My wife, Dale, and I were selling decoys for years, well, probably about 12 years. And in 1984, Jim Julia from Fairfield, Maine, called us and said, hey, I've got a bunch of decoys I need to have cataloged and for an auction. And he hired us to do it, and the auction was successful, and we liked the way we worked together, so we decided to keep on going, and we formed Julia and Guyette, Inc.
Right, I remember, yeah.
And then I bought out Jim in 1991 and sold part of his portion of the company to Frank Schmidt.
Now, does Jim still calls the auctions, though, doesn't he?
Jim does the bid calling for us.
Yeah.
Yes.
He's a great auctioneer. Great guy.
Very good.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's been going ever since Frank bought that share out, and you guys have you've made quite a splash in the decoy world for sure. How many auctions do you run a year currently?
Well, we run three cataloged auctions, one in April in St. Charles, Illinois, at the National Antique Decoy Show, one in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, in July, and then in the fall we have one at the Easton, Maryland Waterfowl Festival. We also have one uncataloged auction at the Ohio Decoy Collector Show in March in Cleveland.
So, do you take in consignments year round for these decoys?
Yes, decoys worth more than $500 we put in the auctions, and then if they're worth less than that, we sell them on our online shopping site.
Oh, I see. And you also have a retail store in Maryland as well.
Yes, we currently have an antique decoy gallery in St. Michael's. We're actually moving that in May to Freeport. Maine.
Really? Wow.
About a block from L.L. Bean's.
Oh, so you're going to move the whole operation up there?
The gallery and the shopping site.
I see. And you'll still have your offices in Maryland?
Yes.
Oh, wow. How about that? So you said you and your wife were collecting decoys. Did this start at a real young age for you?
Yeah, I was 23 and she was 22. We were buying and selling antiques, and we just kept coming across decoys. We were doing it mostly in the maritime provinces, and so we just started buying and selling decoys along with the antiques, and as time went on, we bought more and more decoys and fewer antiques, and eventually it was just all decoys, and then that's when we shifted over to the auctions.
So how did you learn, you know, how did you get your background? I mean, just by handling it, and then did you go into reading up and books and museums and things like that? How did you get your knowledge?
Actually, very little of any sort of research or going to museums or anything like that beforehand. It was mostly we would buy and sell decoys that we purchased in the maritime provinces. We'd buy them for $10 and sell them for $20. You know, we didn't do a lot of research. And then as time went on, you knew if you had something special. And you actually, those were the ones we kept.
Mm.
And then it got to a point where we had to learn more, so we started using the Richard Bourne
oh, yes,
decoy auction catalogs.
Right, right.
To learn from. As a matter of fact, our first two auctions with Jim, Julia, I was constantly referring to those catalogs, you know, as a reference source.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. So what kind of people collect decoys? You know, I know a lot of them, I just think of like a lot of ones that I've have known over the years are avid duck hunters, but they're not all, there's different types of collectors, right?
Yeah, most of them are waterfowl or upland game bird hunters, by far. I mean, you know, the vast majority of them. Other people have come into it more as an investment, and other people have come into it from the more from the folk art side.
Mm-hmm.
But the vast majority are men.
Mm-hmm.
They're over 50, and they hunt and fish.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So now you just mentioned the folk art side. So I think of, I don't know the right term for this, but there's the working decoy, and then there's the decoy that was made just for a decorative purpose. Is there a name for that type of decoy?
Decorative.
Just decorative, okay.
Right.
And those are the ones that sell for the real big money, is that right?
No.
No, not necessarily?
The world's, the two most expensive decoys ever sold were both working.
Really?
Decoys, one was a merganser by Lothrop Holmes that we sold for $856,000. The other one was an Elmer Kroll feeding plover that was $830,000.
Wow.
The third most expensive one was a decorative.
Mm-hmm.
It was made for John C. Phillips by Kroll, by Elmer Kroll.
Is that the one with the preening?
That's the preening pintail. Yeah.
Now that had broken a record years ago, also like at 200.
Yeah, that was sold in 1986 for $319,000, and that was the record until 1987 when we sold a what did we sell? We sold a running curlew from Massachusetts for $335,000.
Mm.
So that was an 11-year record.
Wow. Now, I know a lot of the big money decoys are from Massachusetts. A lot of them are, aren't they? A lot of the carvers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Massachusetts is by far the area where the majority of the most expensive decoys have come from. Virginia would be probably the next closest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So why don't you throw out a couple of names of some of the top carvers? You already said Elmer Kroll.
Yeah, well, certainly Elmer Kroll. If you looked at the top 100 decoys ever sold, his name would be there, the most by far.
Mm-hmm.
And Lothrop Holmes from Kingston, Mass. Joseph Lincoln.
All right.
Hingham,
mm-hmm.
Mass.
Mm-hmm.
Those would be the three. And then, of course, there was this unknown carver from the North Shore where we sold the curlew for $335,000.
Wow.
Also, Nathan Cobb Jr. from the Eastern Shore of Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
A number of his decoys are sold in the $2,000, $3,000, and $4,000 range.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, I remember there was a kind of a, I thought it was an obscure carver, Captain Osgood.
Yes.
Was he also from Massachusetts?
He was from Massachusetts, but I'm trying to think. We've sold some of his decoys for a fair amount of money, but not over $200,000.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Just like there was Hux Canes from Georgetown, South Carolina. His decoys have sold in between $100,000 and $200,000. Lee Dudley, we just sold a ruddy duck for something like $256,000. But I was talking about the ones further up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now what type of play does condition and originality have in when you're looking at a really fine decoy?
Well, in most cases, it's everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's maker and then form for the maker. In other words, a preening decoy will sell for more than one with a normal head position. These are all factors, but condition is everything. I mean, if the Holmes Merganser we sold for $856,000 had, been repainted, it wouldn't have been worth $10,000. Well, it might have been worth $10,000 or $15,000.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. The paint, I know, means everything. And as far as someone caring for decoys, that like in fine art, a lot of times you'll want to make sure you have the right type of varnish. Do people put varnish on decoys?
No, some people put something called finish feeder on them.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of people would prefer more of a drier surface. The main thing is moisture control. You know, if you're in the northeast, or not the northeast, the north, and you have hot air heat, that could be a problem.
Right.
But in general, I mean, once you get down to, say, Maryland and south, it's not really an issue.
Well, as you have in coming up next year, you have a major collection. The name is French. He was an old-time collector.
Yeah, Joe French was one of the first, really, you know, one of the first collectors. He started in 1954. And he was just active. He was active. He was buying decoys at our auction this April, 10 days before he died.
Wow.
He was 90, almost 91. And he's been very active always. He donated a lot of decoys to museums. He would give seminars. I can't imagine how many articles he wrote. I mean, I'm sure he wrote over 100.
Wow. Wow. So I was watching, you have a video on your website, and I watched a little bit of that, and it showed all of his decoy display around a pool that he just had built. And then later on, he said, well, you don't put decoys next to a pool because the chlorine will start to eat away at the finish.
Actually, that was Doc Starr's collection.
Oh, is that right? Oh, okay.
It's Joe's video. Yeah, and that was a problem with Doc Starr's decoys. He did store them there, and that was an issue.
Oh, that's something else. Yeah, so really have to worry about care when you're having, you know, a high-end decoy, how to take good care of it. Like you said, the dry heat, really should be kept in a nice climate control type situation if you're investing a lot of money in one.
Yeah, and most people who are paying $300,000 for a decoy don't have any problem having a climate controlled area to put it.
Just bouncing around a little bit, are there any contemporary carvers that really command like a really high price?
Well, Mark McNair, he's from the Eastern Shore of Virginia. He's been carving since the early 70s. His decoys they vary, and you know, I mean, some of them are more finely done than others, but his really fine examples certainly can bring $3,000 or $4,000 a piece.
Wow, that's really good for a living, because you can pick up a decoy, you know, at a regular, say, a country auction. A lot of times you can pick up a decoy for, you know, that nothing special or anything for $50 or something like that. And but what you deal in is certainly the other end of the scale. But if someone was to get into collecting, just a beginning collector, would you suggest auction is a good way to find them?
Well, what's good about an auction is they're most of them, and you have to check.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even the major auction houses, one of them doesn't guarantee the merchandise. But in general, they're guaranteed, so you do know what you're getting. You know, if you go to an antique show or something and buy a decoy, you're really not sure what you're buying or the condition of it, or for that matter, on someplace like eBay. People aren't necessarily, they just don't know
right
what they're selling.
Mm-hmm. Well, along those lines, every time I ask a specialist or interview a specialist, I always ask them, have there been any fakes of any important decoys, any carvers?
Yeah, there are plenty of fakes around, but they just never get anywhere. In the decoy world, I mean, they just can't move up the ladder.
Mm-hmm.
There are too many people who know too much about things that can spot them. Where you find them, unfortunately, is, you know, like an antique dealer has 20 decoys in their collection, and one of, you know, you said, you go to there to appraise it or something, one of them's a fake.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly because they're not, the people aren't there. The decoy collecting community it's a very sociable group of people. They're always going over to each other's houses looking at decoys. And
right.
And wait a minute, something's not right here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they start to look into it and send somebody a photograph and get it figured out. Then it goes back and it's dangerous business because it is fraud.
Right, right.
So, I mean, people can get in a lot of trouble for trying to pass off fakes, and the decoy business is really not the place to do it because they're apt to get
Well, I've seen a number of fake ice fishing decoys, you know, those
fish.
They're like everywhere. Yeah.
And there are plenty of fake other decoys, too. They usually do something wrong, like make them too heavy to float right. Or, you know that, Edwin Bachman never painted the bottom of any of his decoys, but the faker doesn't know that.
Ah, wow.
So they paint the bottom.
Yeah.
You know, there's always a giveaway.
Sure, yeah. Now, you mentioned earlier marsh birds. What other kind of decoys were carved other than, say, geese and ducks and marsh birds? Is that basically the majority of it?
Well, by marsh birds, do you mean shorebirds?
Shorebirds, yes.
By far shorebirds, those are the three. There were also confidence decoys, like seagulls or herons.
Oh, really?
Someone put off to the side.
Huh, how about that?
Just to make the scene a little more normal.
Uh-huh. Now, I've seen swan decoys before, too, right?
Yeah, they were used both ways. I mean, there was a time when swans were hunted, and then they were also used as confidence decoys.
So, what are some good working decoys? Like, I know there's, is it Mason in the Midwest? Is that who I'm thinking of? What are some good working decoys to collect today that really hold their value?
Well, Mason decoys are very good to collect simply because there are so many grades and species. You can say, okay, I want to collect one of every challenge grade Mason or something like that. You know, so it works out well, and a lot of people collect them. There's also a lot of literature available about them. Certainly the Ward Brothers.
Ward Brothers, yeah.
And Kroll, you know, there are also good Elmer Kroll decoys for $3,000. They don't have to be the expensive ones. I find that decoys that are a good investment tend to be the ones that, if new people come in, those are the ones they buy. And they gravitate toward the names.
Right.
That's why I say Mason, Ward Brothers, Charles Perdue, Elmer Kroll, Joe Lincoln, Gus Wilson.
Oh, yes.
You know, they go to the name and rather than the unknown, and they don't go to the obscure names. They go to the names that are in the forefront. So, consequently, people are coming, you know, new collectors are coming in, buying that type of item and driving the price up. So those are good investments.
Now, did I see a Gus Wilson penguin before, or a bear or something? Did he do other things?
Yeah, he'd made some decorative carvings. He made quite a few songbirds, like robins, but he also made a couple of tigers. I don't know exactly how large they were. They weren't full-size. I know a folk art collector in Portland, Maine had them years ago, you know, like 25 years ago. I don't know what happened to them.
Now, was he from Maine?
Gus?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was the lighthouse keeper up in Port Clyde for years, and that's where he made his larger, more sculpturesque decoys because they were used out on the open water. They had to be larger and broader to work right and to be seen right. And he also, that's where he made what's called his Monhegan Island style. He sold a lot to the people from Monhegan Island to use. The boat traffic was constant back and forth between Monhegan and Port Clyde, so it was almost like it was the next town. He moved to, that was at the turn of the century. Later, I don't know exactly when, say in the 20s, he moved to South Portland, and made most of his commercial decoys there. They were a little simpler than the Monhegan Island style, and also smaller because they were used in the back bays as opposed to out in the open water.
Now, wasn't there someone named Hart, too, that was sort of similar?
Hart is not similar.
Oh, okay.
Hart was from Gloucester.
Yeah, okay.
He's the one who carved the penguins.
Oh, okay, that's who I'm thinking of.
Yeah, and he carved songbirds, and he carved decoys. The decoys aren't much of anything to speak of as far as form or value.
So you have when it comes to the very high end pieces, you know, the record pieces, is it just a real small circle of people that are the bidders on that type of thing?
Well, it depends on number. I mean, you know, first of all, only three decoys have sold for over 800,000, and I don't have the information in front of me, but, you know, maybe 15 have sold for over 500,000, or 20. But when you get below that, what happens is people can trade up. We get people who will come to our auction, and, you know, they'll talk to me beforehand. You know, Gary, look, I really like the such and such. If I buy that, can I, you know, give you decoys to put in the next auction? And what happens is people have a large decoy collection. You know, they may have they may not be able to afford to buy a $400,000 decoy, but they can afford to give up $400,000 worth of their decoys. So they'll buy that decoy and give us 20 decoys for the next auction to pay for it. So a lot of people who don't necessarily go around just buying things for $400,000 are able to do it that way.
I see.
So there are quite a few people who, you know, there's certainly 50 people who are potential customers for, say, a $250,000 decoy.
Now, are there associations or clubs or anything?
All over.
There are, yeah.
Yeah. The biggest ones, the Midwest Decoy Collectors Club, there are... I'm sure where their office is, but they're the ones that have the show that we have our auction at in St. Charles, Illinois. There's a Long Island Decoy Collectors Club. There's a club on the Pacific Coast. They have a show once a year in Mount Vernon, Washington. I went out there to that show this year. It was pretty neat.
Yeah.
And there's the Minnesota's. There's a Minnesota club. There's an Ohio club. There's a Canadian club. There are a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
Louisiana.
Well, do people collect regionally?
The majority of people collect regionally. The people with the bigger, better collections tend to collect what they like, what they collect nationally, or, you know, plus Canada. They don't seem to just collect by the region.
Oh, I see. So, if you were if you were like really interested in learning, say, just say that there's someone listening to this right now that's a novice, what would you and just starting to get interested, what would you suggest they do?
Well, the best thing for them to do is, you know, get a copy of Decoy Magazine or look online, find out where the shows are. You know, if there's a show nearby, go to it, or an auction, a decoy auction. Auction catalogs are a great reference. And look at the websites. You know, there's a lot of information on people, certainly on the auction house websites, and then other people have websites. I know a great one is what's it called, eDecoy. It's Joe and Donna Tonelli's site, and they're in Spring Valley, Illinois. But it's very educational. It shows you a lot of stuff about decoy collecting and about the decoy collecting community. It's a very social activity, and if you go to the shows, you'll meet people that have similar interests. It's just an opportunity to meet some really good people and wind up, you know, knowing them for a long time, collecting decoys with them, and usually they wind up hunting together. It's a good deal.
I've gone to a number of decoy auctions just out of interest, and I've always thought that people are pretty nice there. People that attend, interesting people, and certainly all kinds. You've been around and working this business for quite a while, so what kind of changes have you seen the internet has done to this?
Well, the internet has, of course, opened up this whole area for us personally with the for our business with our online shopping site, which has been great for us. That has enabled us to, take decoys from people that we would have left in the past. They don't want that. They want you to take them all.
Sure.
And it also has been an opportunity for us to present new buyers decoys that they can be confident in what they're getting because they're guaranteed. And also in the price structure. You know, I mean, if it's a $300 decoy, it's $300. It's not $500. And that's important so they don't get discouraged. The internet has really just kind of opened the whole thing up. I don't know what it's like today for antique auction houses, but I know at one point they seemed to be being hurt by the internet. And, you know, it would bypass the auction house. People would bypass the auction houses, whereas with us it's just added. I mean, it's people are constantly able to view your site and get a hold of you, and people, you know, just have, there's more information available, you know, on decoys, so it's been really good.
Sure, and also, do you sell live online?
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah, there's internet bidding. Mm-hmm. That's been good. You know, I'm happy to have it.
Mm-hmm.
It can be a little frustrating because, it's, you know, you have to keep up with it as far as it's easy for them to miss a bid.
Yes.
Or their bid to be missed because there's an extra hesitation there, you know, one step more than a phone bidder.
Right. Yes. I just did an interview recently with, someone that was said the buyer flew in from Hong Kong. This was to buy Michael Jackson's glove because he didn't want to miss the bid. And that's really, you know, I mean, the only sure way you have of really making sure you get the bid is being there, because there's all kinds of things can happen in phone bids, absentee bids.
Oh, yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
So these things just tend to happen now and then. So why don't you give out your website address? It's a little, someone has to get a pen and paper. You have to spell it out, right?
Sure. It's decoys at Guyette, G-U-Y-E-T-T-E, A-N-D, and Schmidt, S-C-H-M-I-D-T .com.
Yeah. Now, I've met you a couple of times, and Frank, I've met several times. He's off traveling now?
Yeah, he's somewhere traveling around Missouri right now.
Oh, nice, nice. Well, I think that's... I think that, what do you think, that, just one other question, what do you think that the future of decoy collecting will be? I mean, are there a lot of new people getting into it?
Well, things are a lot different now than they were a year and a half ago. You know, right now we're just kind of coasting. We haven't, the decoy business hasn't been hit as hard as the antique business by this recession. But, you know, we're still, people are still cautious. And you, of course, because of the economy, there are less people with disposable income. So right now, it's just sort of coasting along. I mean, I'm sure it'll change again in the future, in the not very distant future. And one of the things I think will give it a spark is French's collection. I mean, there are people already making hotel reservations, you know, from Europe and all over the place to come to the sale.
Wow, yeah, I was just like I said earlier, if you look at the video on their website, you'll see there's a couple of video, two videos on the French collection, very interesting. So that's some great old pictures in there from the 50s, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that should be a real a barnstormer, that auction.
Well, what's really interesting about his stuff, there's two things. One, almost every decoy in the collection is pictured in some article somewhere.
Wow.
And actually, there are three things. That's one. The other thing is a lot of that stuff he bought in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the story is, in a, like Mackie has a book about getting these eight Dilly plovers, John Dilly plovers, from Eugene Birdsell's, or Jess Birdsell's widow. That's what he called, he thought they were made by Jess Birdsell. Turns out they were Dillies. You know, and Joe French has two of those, and he has decoys he bought from the Staten Island Museum in 1956, so which is pretty incredible. But the other thing is, he has a lot of decoys that are only worth $1,000.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So it's not like a McCleary sale. You know, it's like, it's not filled with 50,000 and $500,000 decoys. It's, you know, it's filled with, you know, $1,000 and $2,000 and $5,000 decoys, so a lot more people have the opportunity to participate.
And with that type of provenance, you know, it might some pieces will certainly take off.
Sure. Oh yeah.
Yeah. Well, this has been great, Gary. Really nice talking to you, and thank you for all the information.
Okay.
All right, and I'll talk to you soon. Take care now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was Gary Guyette of Guyette and Schmidt Incorporated, the world's leading antique decoy auction company. We may have a second part series on decoys. I'm speaking with another gentleman who is a collector and a cataloger of decoys. That's it today for the Antique Auction Podcast. This is Martin Willis signing off.
Wait, don't go away. I want to talk to you about how you can help us out. We love doing this show. We do it for free. However, we do have some expenses, and you can help us without even realizing you're doing it. And that is, if you're going to purchase something on Amazon, why not go to our website, www.antiqueauctionpodcast.com. Up in the right-hand corner, you'll see there's an Amazon search engine. You can search for your item there, and if you purchase it, we will receive a small fee. That'll help us carry on. Thank you, and I hope you enjoyed today's show.